Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Recently, EPF launched its account to support facility, which may assist some of its members in obtaining personal financing from banking institutions. Now, the question is whether this initiative will placate those calling for another round of EPF withdrawals. And what policy safeguards should be considered now to avert a retirement saving crisis in the near future? Dr. Melati Nungsari joins me now. She's an Associate Professor of Economics at the Asia School of Business. Melati, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I'm wondering if we could begin our conversation today just with your thoughts on the account to support facility from EPF. And also what you make of these continued comments that people still seem to make, that it would in fact be simpler to just allow people to withdraw directly from their savings. They say, many proponents say that actually, well, you know, it's their money, it's their savings after all.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me here. So I think there are a couple things with regards to this. And I think the first thing is, I generally think that this is sort of one way for contributors to kind of solve what we call like short-term liquidity issues and sort of spread this across a couple of years, because there are sort of rules or kind of requirements that I think EPF is imposing with this. But the issue is that eventually they will sort of, your savings will be run down. I think it sort of postpones that and provides you a little bit of liquidity in the short term. Now, I personally feel that I think saving withdrawals, as you said, have sort of repeatedly happened throughout the pandemic. And I think they actually have sort of been highly politicized and kind of takes us away from a number of issues that sort of underlies all of this. I kind of think about these withdrawals that really started from COVID are kind of like Band-Aids, right? So you have a wound, you put on a Band-Aid, and you move forward, but you're not really treating kind of the underlying wound and why it's there in the first place. And so, you know, thinking about things like low wages, which is one of our problems, thinking about wage growth, thinking about increased social support, I feel like the withdrawals part is sort of taking our attention away from, I think, pretty salient matters, structural issues, I think, that need to be looked at. And also, I think there is a sense in which we should kind of think about, you know, the reason why EPF exists. I don't like to be academic, but there is this sort of term called time discounting. So we tend to sort of, you know, value the present more. We don't really think about the future very much. And that's the reason why we have, you know, account one in EPF and why we can't take it out, because planning tends to be harder with, you know, some of these psychological biases. And so I think we're sort of in a dire state. And I think one of the statistics that was quite worrying to me was, it was released that 81%, I think, of contributors below 55 are not going to be able to live above poverty level at this sort of level of savings, which I think points to what you were saying, which is that we're going to have a huge retirement crisis. And we already have one, I think, currently.
Okay. Well, I want to follow up on the point where you said that, you know, it has been highly politicized, to be honest with you. EPF withdrawals has been the subject of much political fodder. But we're not alone in this, because I see other countries around the world also having, you know, facing a retirement savings crisis, facing debates and issues around access to retirement savings and sufficiency of of retirement savings. What can we learn from the fact that this seems to be universal? And what can we take from the experiences and lessons from other countries? Might that fit a Malaysian context, an EPF context?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question, actually. So I think we've all been seeing social media and news posts about France. So France, currently, the debate is basically about raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. And that is causing a kind of huge riots and protests all across the country. And so I think that kind of points to one interesting kind of issue that relates to the political economy of things, which is that raising retirement ages, which is something that I think you can do a whole session on, is something very politically unpalatable. It causes a lot of social unrest. You're essentially telling people that they cannot retire for a couple more years, or you know, many people will sort of end up working into the years that they consider their golden years. And so I think that is something that you know, we should sort of expect if the government were to make retirement age kind of changes. I'm not arguing that it's necessary or not at this point, but I think it sort of gives a sense, you know, if something is politically unfavorable and there are kind of political considerations at hand, I feel like it's probably not a move the government is going to take. But there are other issues, of course, surrounding, you know, retirement. So there are a limited amount of what we call instruments, so things that the government can help to induce more savings. Raising retirement age could be one of them.
What are some of the other policy interventions that the government may consider? And again, you're absolutely right. We have to kind of look at this with what is most politically expedient for policymakers to implement.
So I think there are two things here. I think in the 2023 budget, there was actually some expansion to the Aisaraan program under EPF. So for those of you not familiar, so Aisaraan is supposed to be a retirement savings scheme for self-employed people, for gig economy workers, and for housewives, actually. And so I think thinking about sort of marginal increases or marginal incentives could actually help quite a bit. But one thing I was a bit surprised about with Aisaraan was actually how little the government matching was in relation to sort of, you know, you put in some money, the government matches some amount. I think in budget 2023 is only 300 ringgit, which I don't think is enough. So I would sort of be thinking about pushing for policies that sort of are within the ecosystem already and trying to get those to incentivize people more. But the other thing, though, I should point out is also the fact that, you know, the withdrawal, EPF withdrawals was actually something that was fairly uncommon across the world during stimulus packages. And it was actually kind of packaged as the government's help when it was actually kind of letting people withdraw their own money. And so I think this is actually unique. The withdrawals itself are sort of a bit of a unique situation to Malaysia. Some other countries did it, but the majority of other countries, I think, did not, you know, let people tap into long-term benefits.
Okay. All right. That's interesting to note. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the fact that what you quoted just now about, was it 80%+ of EPF members who may not be able to live above the poverty line post-retirement? And I'm thinking about that, and I'm just wondering what the consequences are for us as a society, for government, when such a huge segment of the population might be living in poverty in their older years.
So I think there's actually, so it's surprising how high it is, I think the first thing, but also kind of jives with, I think, what we know. But I think there are a couple of different things that sort of make this worse. The first is actually thinking about sort of intergenerational effects. So there have been a lot of learning losses due to COVID, which actually does translate in lower wages. So for the COVID generation, we kind of worry about, you know, like thinking about the adult children not having enough money and then their parents also not having enough money and sort of having a household basically that is suffering due to basically lack of income from multiple individuals. So I think that is something that has always been very concerning, but I think with COVID, that sort of has made it worse. And I think we can expect, you know, a lot of things to happen, right? So we're thinking about now, why are wages so low? A reason is because Malaysian employers in particular are sort of reliant very much on cheap labor. You know, innovation is sort of a bit, using tech is a bit, you know, less desired or less done. And so I think this will sort of perpetuate, I think, poverty will perpetuate companies not kind of trying to rely on sort of higher labor, higher wages. And so I think this is sort of like a cycle that we want to escape, and we've been trying very hard to escape, but this will certainly not help.
Okay, that's long, kind of more long-term structural issues that we need to address. What about the social safety net, particularly for financially vulnerable older Malaysians?
Yeah, so that's another thing I think that we sort of need to plan ahead, right? So I think for the Aisaraan, so I just like to bring back this program because I think it's fantastic, but I think it should be expanded. I think social support in the form of trying to incentivize people to save as much as possible now, when they're in their 40s, when they're in their late 30s, even thinking about the future, I think will definitely help. But also thinking about how we're going to take care of our elderly. I think that's a conversation we haven't really thought very much about, like in terms of, nursing homes, in terms of, you know, end of life care, in terms of healthcare, I think is a huge part when we're thinking about an aging society. And none of that has really been addressed in much detail, but this compounded with the fact that people not have enough retirement savings is going to be a huge problem.
Right. Do you think that, you know, even before COVID hit and we were allowed the special drawdowns, already I think EPF had a huge segment of members who didn't have that much in their savings. Are there enough efforts being done to rebuild those reduced savings that happened during the pandemic period?
No, I think not, actually. I think there can be more done. I do think that employment has sort of recovered a little bit. So people now have sort of solid jobs and have EPF contributions. But I do also feel that we should be thinking about the population that's not covered by EPF, right? We know there are millions of them out there. And so what are they doing? What's happening with their retirement savings? I often feel like the public discourse focuses maybe perhaps a bit too much on EPF and not overall societally how we should deal with this.
Right, and that is a huge policy blind spot, I would say, in terms of our social safety net. Is there anything that's being done to catch those that are not covered by the EPF net?
There are. So I think EPF has been trying very hard to do this. I mentioned ISARAAN just now. So that is, you know, thinking about people who work in the gig economy. I think one thing that has been quite clear is that the nature of work for a lot of people has changed. And if you talk to young people, some of them are like, you know, I don't want an office job and I want flexibility in an employer who sort of pays me well, but understands my my needs and, you know, what I basically want from a career. And because of that, I think we need to be a bit more, I think, out of the box a little bit with regards to trying to get those people who do maybe different types of consultancies or work on sort of contract basis to try and get them saved because they're part of our society, right? And so in a way, they're actually more vulnerable because they don't have the guarantees of an employer on their side.
All right. Melati, thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate your time. That was Dr. Melati Nungsari from the Asia School of Business. And we're going to take a very quick break here on Consider This. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. Let's continue our conversation about the EPF Account 2 support facility. Now, the EPF Account 2 has once again become a hot topic recently. This was after Prime Minister and Finance Minister Anwar Ibrahim had said last month that the government was considering using EPF savings as collateral for emergency loans. This in response to the opposition's repeated calls for more EPF withdrawals to be allowed. EPF has now launched an account to support facility, which may assist some members in obtaining personal financing from banking institutions. Joining me now to discuss this further is Shakira Teh Sharifuddin. She's a senior economist at the World Bank. Shakira, thank you for joining me on the show. It turns out that about 60,000 EPF, 60,000 members had applied for the EPF facility to support bank loans. Clearly, there are many who need access to some liquidity, but only half, actually less than half of those who applied were found to be eligible. I'm wondering if we could begin our conversation with your thoughts on the Account 2 support facility. What do you make of it? What are some of the pros and cons that you've considered with this facility?
Sure. Thanks, Melissa. I think let's be clear a little bit on the savings facility, the support facility that EPF recently announced. So basically what it is, it's a facility that allows EPF members to apply for personal financing from banking institutions. So your savings in account two with the banking can be used as to secure personal financing with banking institutions, and they would be able to use that funds for repayment at a later date when you reach withdrawal age. So I think the whole intention of this support facility comes at a time where a lot of individuals or households, as you said earlier, are facing this rising cost of pressure from high cost of living, as well as some liquidity crunch or financial pressures. And now, I mean, if we compare that to the other alternative, the proposal, which is for withdrawals, and obviously this is a much more palatable approach or options. However, I think one thing it does raise a few questions. One thing is, what's the impact on EPF savings when they hit withdrawal age later at 55 or 50? And so I think this is also a very unusual practice in global experience. So if you look at other institutions similar to EPF in other parts of the world, this is something that they would generally avoid, this particular measure. And obviously, it puts a big significant risk on this initiative, basically, that it could further deplete retirement savings. So as we all know, a large majority of EPF members do not have adequate retirement savings. And I think my final point to this is, all of this conversation that we had about the support facility or withdrawals, it distracts or takes away from the actual serious conversation that we need to have, which is, number one, is to address the pressures on cost of living through raising income and wages. And second is to strengthen the current social protection system in the country. So that's my take on that, on the EPF support facility. Yeah,
I really like that point about how all the focus around EPF withdrawals has taken away from some of the, I mean, it's a symptom, not the cause, right? The causes are cost of living, maybe wage suppression and all of that. But just very quickly, Shakira, I want to address the mindset that a lot of people have. So what underlies the argument for more EPF withdrawals is the basic assumption that this is our money, in our savings, and that the choice should be left to the individual whether or not to withdraw. Can you weigh in on that? How should we, many of us who are EPF contributors, be thinking about retirement funds?
I think, from my personal opinion, there needs to be a clearer and more honest communication about what EPF saving is for. I think it's true that, you know, there is certain segment of the society that thinks my money, my choice. But at the end of the day, it needs to be communicated to them that this is for retirement. That's one. And I think back to my point earlier about strengthening the current social protection and social assistance in the country, that's very key. That would be the one that would provide, that should provide some relief to individuals or households, right, rather than turning into their savings fund, retirement funds.
So in the during the explanation of the account to support facility, EPF had mentioned that, if I may quote them, they said that Malaysia is on the cusp of a retirement crisis. What are your thoughts on this? Are we facing a looming retirement saving crisis?
To answer shortly, Melissa, yes, we are facing a retirement crisis. And I guess for three big reasons why, you know, we are in the current situation that we are facing right now. The first is, I think Malaysia is aging rapidly. Essentially, we are growing older faster. So back in 2020, Malaysia reached aging nation status. And by that, it means that 7% of the population are above the age 65. And so the projection shows that within the span of about 24 years, that number will double and we will become an age nation. So essentially 14% of the population are above 65 years old. Now, this is actually quite rapid and quite fast, especially if we compare that to other high-income countries. So for example, Australia transitioned from an aging to an age country within a span of 73 years. The US did it in 69 years, and for France, it's 110. So obviously 24 is very, very fast for Malaysia. So that's the first reason, we are aging faster. And then within this context, obviously most of Malaysians are not financially prepared for retirement. And then the pandemic basically exacerbated the situation. Mm-hmm. So even before the pandemic, I think the statistic shows that retirement savings for almost 75% of EPF members would have a monthly benefit of less than 1,050 ringgit. So that's very, very small. And obviously this has worsened since. And the multiple withdrawals that we saw during the pandemic, yes, it did provide some relief and it helped to free up some of the liquidity crunch that households face. but obviously it has a significant impact on retirement savings. I think the Deputy Finance Minister came out in Parliament and, you know, provided some statistics. I think the median EPF savings for those below 55 years old, for Bukun Putra, for example, is 4,900 ringgit. And that is far cry from what EPF considers to be adequate for one to have about 600,000 by the age of 55. So that's the second. Yeah, that's quite an alarming statistic. And then third, our current social protection system does not provide adequate safety nets for those without adequate retirement saving. And this includes a lot of those who are employed in the informal sectors or self-employed workers. I mean, a lot of our discussions are on EPF so far, you know, EPF mm-hmm. members and EPF savings. But just to give you some rough idea, so in 2019, about 12% of our labor force are with the civil service or military. And then about another 49% is with EPF. And so that makes it about 40% of the labor force were neither covered by EPF nor any form of pension system. So it is certainly a big issue here. So we are getting older faster. We do not have enough savings. And then a lot of us are not adequately covered by the current social protection system. So that basically, yes, to sum it up, we are on the cusp of a retirement crisis.
Wow. Okay. If I may get you to elaborate. So I might pull on the last two options that points that you put forth. The fact that the drawdowns in the past few years during the pandemic had also reduced a lot of people's EPF balances. How do we think about rebuilding what was lost? I mean, would be increasing the contribution rate now that, you know, the economy is doing slightly better, would be increasing the contribution rate for both employers and employees be a feasible option to help rebuild some of those dwindling balances?
I mean, if we're talking about increasing contribution, I think the combined EPF contribution right now is about 23 to 24%. And that's actually already high by international and regional standards. So it's not really the most obvious solution. And I think there are some sort of potential side effects that could come with raising contributions. So from the employer side, it could reduce the competitiveness of the Malaysian workforce, for example. And then for the employee side, increasing contribution only reduces your disposable income at the end of the month. So actually, we would have less to spend, and we are back at square one on the same place where we begin with. Yeah.
Understood. Okay. And what about the social protection for those who are not covered by EPF? You are absolutely right. We focus a lot on the conversation about EPFs, but we forget so many Malaysians are not even covered by EPF. How do we think about making sure they don't fall through the gaps in a retirement crisis?
Well, I would say two big approaches to that. Number one, I'm going to keep coming back to strengthening the social protection system, because we need to have an adequate or a safety net to cover for every single working population, including those not covered by EPF or any form of pension. That's the first one. And I think there are some initiatives that have been put in place, for example, to bring in more informal workers or gig workers into the EPF contribution system. And that has launched. But I think one approach that could be done is greater matching. So for now, the contribution from government is fairly small. Increasing that contribution could help address some of the issues, though not entirely, particularly for those not covered by EPF or pension.
Shigria, is there anything missing from the conversation? You know, when we talk about it, it really resonated with me when you said that, you know, this is all really detracting from the main issues at hand. What's missing from the conversation? What should we be highlighting more than a conversation about whether or not to have more withdrawals?
I think first is for us at the bank, we continue to push this message that we need to build our fiscal buffers so that the government has adequate funds to finance some of the social protection measures, social assistance measures that we already have in place, and to strengthen that framework. I think that's one. The second, I think, as I said, we at the beginning, we can't lose sight of the focus that we need clear policy directions in terms of raising income for individuals and households. both in the short term, that's usually through social assistance or social protection, but also over the longer term. And that means bringing more quality investments, putting in more high-value jobs so that people can have the opportunity to raise their income and hence raise their contribution and retirement savings later. I think one thing I would like to add is, particularly when it comes to retirement, this whole thing is such a complex issue. We talk about the economic challenges that we see earlier, but at the same time, because retirement, I think, is quite a personal and delicate matter to every working adult, right? And it touches upon a period of time where we are more vulnerable or most vulnerable. So communication in terms of hard policy decisions, key policy decisions, has to be done clearly and honestly so that there is acceptance in some of the measures going forward, because only then some of the hard reforms can take place.
Shakira, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight. I appreciate your time. Shakira Tesharifuddin there from the World Bank, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.